You're listening to Proof to Product, and this is episode 7. We're taking you behind the scenes with entrepreneurs that run product-based businesses, people that were once in your shoes. Our TSBC alumni, speakers, and friends will shed light on growth strategies, resources, and inspiration to help you scale your creative business. Hey everyone, this is Katie Hunt, the founder of Trade Show Bootcamp, and today I have Meg Sutton of Bell & Union with me. She started Bell & Union in 2012 and attended paper camp prior to exhibiting at the National Stationery Show. Meg started Bell & Union with a focus on American-made handmade goods, and since then, she's had a ton of growth in their business. She's exhibiting at lots of shows, I think 3 a year for the past few years, expanding their product line into home and gift items, and she's been working with sales reps. So Meg, I'm super excited to have you join us on the podcast today. Thank you.
Yeah, excited to be here. You make me sound better than I think it is.
Oh, stop. So let's start at the beginning. I want to hear, how did you decide to start Bell & Union? What was your motivation there and your goals?
Sure. Well, when I was in college, I worked at a cute little gift shop in downtown Savannah. And it was really there that I first got exposed to letterpress and the greeting card industry, in the sense that a lot of us know it, not the standard Hallmark cards. And I remember coming into the shop one day and just having a complete mental breakdown about having to go into the horrible world of corporate graphic design. And my boss at the time just started laughing at me. And that day she signed me up to go to the stationery show with her as a buyer. That was back in 2009.
Okay.
So we went and walked the show, and I felt like my eyes were just open to this whole world that I didn't know existed. And I walked away knowing this is what I want to do when I grow up.
Yeah.
Still waiting on the growing up part.
Me too. Me too.
So I got married, graduated college, went and worked at an ad agency for a year and hated every minute of it. Went back to the stationery show in 2011 to walk it with fresh eyes and just thinking, can I do this? Is this the next step for me? I had been doing custom wedding invitations on my own at the time. Really kind of felt like I was having two full-time jobs between the ad agency and the custom work. Walked the show. I specifically remember crying on the steps of the Japanese, overwhelmed because I didn't feel like I knew anything more than I did when I got there. And my friend who was with me said, it's because you already knew you could do this.
Yeah.
I mean, you weren't going to learn anything else. You've already got everything you need. I went home. I quit my job after a good conversation with my husband.
Right.
And Bell & Union was born. So I spent the next year working on a collection. And I literally launched to the world wholesale, retail, whole nine yards for the first time at the stationery show in 2012.
Oh, I love that. Yeah, you're my kind of gal too. I did the whole launch at the show situation too. And
I mean, in my mind, there was no other way to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, it was just, we're going to dive in.
Yeah.
The aftermath was another story, but
right.
Sure, I mean, it was amazing. I had done TSBC, I guess, in the early spring before this show. And I remember one of the people had said, you know, don't worry if you only get one order. Like, it's okay. Like, you're not there just for orders. You're making contacts and, you know, it'll be great. So I wanted one order. That's all I wanted.
Yeah.
And I walked away, I think, with close to 50 orders at that show.
That's
and
awesome.
It was just, it was an incredible feeling. And it kind of validated what I was doing and where I wanted to go with things. And it's been history.
That's awesome. We talked at Paper Camp recently about, you know, as I always do, setting your goals and making sure that your goals for anything, but particularly trade shows, isn't just tied to sales. We really recommend that you look at all the non-quantifiable ways that you can benefit from attending these shows, the contacts you'll make, the relationships you'll build, getting feedback on your products. And then, of course, you know, the sales are great too, but you also grow your Rolodex, so to speak. Does anyone use a Rolodex anywhere? I don't know.
Like, I have been searching for one.
Have you
seriously?
Really?
Yes. Okay. I have, you're going to laugh because I can show this to you. I have a basket on my desk of business. And it is not organized in any way, shape, or form, and it drives me batty.
That's
so
awesome.
That may be a new product in the works.
There you go. Bring the Rolodex back. No, yeah. But shows are a great way for other exposure. And you know, that still doesn't mean that they're right for everybody. But I do think what you said about going in with a goal for one order, that's super important. You want to know before you go to do anything, whether it's a show or launch to wholesale, what are your goals around that? So, you know, you've had a really strong brand ever since the start. You've had a really strong focus and a company mission on focusing on handmade goods. Talk about that a little bit and how it has transitioned, because you started with paper goods and now you've really elaborated into home goods and textiles and a whole bunch of other stuff. So talk about your mission and how that was kind of at the forefront.
Sure. When we launched in 2012, you know, I knew we needed to have probably between 40 and 50 SKUs, thanks to my TSBC knowledge. 30 of that was cards. You know, the letterpress greeting cards were definitely the core of the line. And then on a whim, I decided to add a couple of tea towels just for fun. And at the time, nobody was really doing that at the stationery show, and it was a huge hit for us. So we kind of knew we wanted to grow that side of things. And so when we went back the next year, we added 6 new towel designs, and they were just as successful. And we kind of started to find that we had this niche in the foodie market. A lot of our cards are based around kind of food puns or, you know, Southern phrases, that kind of thing. Because who doesn't love food?
Right.
So we kind of found our niche in that market, and we just decided to run with it. So we started showing at the gift show in August of 14. And so we knew we kind of needed to expand more into the gift side of things to kind of create that balance. And we had the tea towels, and that was great. Let's see, in January of 15 was really our big crossover into the gift and home side of things. So we launched an entire kitchen collection at that show. So we expanded the tea towels. We had a recipe box, hand-carved wooden utensils. So just really kind of outfitting the kitchen from a gift perspective. And kind of from the beginning, with the name of the company being Bell & Union, it was really important to me to make sure that everything we do is American-made. Not only is the name patriotic, but there's a symbolism behind it too. So my husband was a soldier in the U.S. Army for 6 years, and that really kind of shaped my perspective on business, actually, in a lot of ways, because I'm watching these men and women literally go to countries I can't find on a map to protect our freedom. And for me, I wanted to figure out a way to give back to them as a way to say thank you. And the best way that I knew how to do that was to honor their commitment to our country by keeping my goods made here, this place that they're trying so hard to protect. So that was kind of really what guided things from the beginning. So it took us a long time. Our products definitely probably have a little bit longer of a development phase, I would say, just because of all the research. I can tell you personally, there is an end to Google. It does end. So that's been interesting. It took us about a year to essentially create our own supply chain on our tea towels. So literally, we have to work with the farmers in West Texas growing their cotton. That gets sent to a loomer in North Carolina, and then it gets to a finisher in South Carolina. They get stitched in Georgia, and then they get screen printed. I mean, it is a multi-step process. It was an exhausting nightmare at the time trying to put it all together. But now that we've got that, it's something that we're really proud of and we can really stand behind. So yeah, the American made has definitely been a driving force behind the company and something that we've stuck through the whole time.
I love that you shared that whole process. Okay. I want to dial in on that a little bit more, because, you know, when we talk about research and development of new products, everyone has to research the cost involved and how you're going to make it happen and all these things, but that is more intense.
It's more than just, you know, find the paper, print the card.
Right. And it's, you know, find the paper, print the card has a much more dialed in price point where you can weigh what your margins are going to be and you can determine if you can make this profitable in the wholesale market. So you're not only sourcing these materials to create the end product, but then you're having to factor in, is this going to be worthwhile? Is this going to be something that's going to make my business money? How do you do that? What's your process for that?
A lot of math that I was not prepared for when I started this company.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have to consider market value on any product you're going to create, whether that's greeting cards, and margins are definitely a driving factor behind anything you do. So the first line of tea towels we created were actually on an Indian-based cotton towel. So the towels were finished here in the US and stitched and that sort of thing, but the cotton originated in India and I never felt good about it. So it only lasted about 2 months.
Okay.
So I kind of at least had an idea of what pricing looked like mm-hmm. from foreign countries and, you know, doing a lot of market research on competitors and that sort of thing. So I knew where we needed to be. It just took a lot of handholding from the vendors involved in the process to make sure we got the numbers all lined up. I mean, I'd be curious to see someone else's books. We're probably not making as much as we should be, but we do tend to stick to the standard, like, 2.2 formula kind of thing. So your materials and labor times that 2.2. And we try really hard to stick to that. And I'm happy to say on almost everything we do, we're competitive within the market.
Good.
So our American-made goods are going to be around the same cost as something made overseas. And I think that's a really big accomplishment.
It is. It's huge.
It's practically impossible to do anything American-made anymore. Yeah. People think I'm lying half the time. So.
And I liked what you said too about how some materials being sourced overseas but then finished here. I was just talking with somebody recently about that and they were saying, well, then is it truly American made at that point? Yeah. And yeah, it's in some eyes it probably is, in most eyes it's probably not though. And so the fact that you've then cultivated this way of creating the products here from start to finish, I think it's pretty incredible. How do you decide what to move forward on and what ideas to scrap when you go through this whole long process?
Cost usually dictates a lot. I hate saying that. I mean, we've had some great ideas that we've really loved and a couple of things that we moved forward on that we probably shouldn't have. We did cutting boards for a little while and I loved them. They fit the brand great, but we really just weren't making our margins on them. So at the end of the day, it just didn't make sense.
Right.
So we did, I think, just one or two batches of those before we decided, you know what, this really just wasn't the best call. And so we had to let that go. And I mean, it's trial and error with yeah. anything for sure. Knowing that we've kind of found that niche in the foodie market, usually anything kitchen related kind of guides us. And taking that one step further into the gift market, it's like, I'm thinking of what is my grandmother using in her kitchen? Because for me, something I think about when I'm making new things is if someone were to walk into a vintage shop 50 years from now, I want them to find my goods still as good as they were the day that I made them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's what gives me goosebumps kind of thing. So, I mean.
I was just going to say, yeah. I totally got goosebumps talking about your grandma. And yeah. Oh, I love that.
It's quality. I mean, and that's another good reason for doing the American made. I can control that quality for sure. So it's just price definitely determines a lot. So it's we've kind of learned what works and what doesn't. We've kind of recently ventured more into ceramics within the kitchen, which I absolutely adore. But I've also learned it's very expensive.
Yeah.
So
is that difficult to scale too in terms of fulfilling larger orders?
No, scale is actually the easy part because with ceramics, what they do is they create a production mold. Mm. And so once you have that production mold, they can make as many as you need and it's good. The problem is getting your production mold. You're going to spend several thousand dollars just to get your first sample. Wow. And that's on a product that may or may not do well in the market.
A little bit different than getting a plate for your letterpress,
yes,
right?
Very much so. So that's why we only have three ceramic things right now, because it's always a little bit more of a gamble. Mm-hmm. We've been fortunate in that so far those have done okay. So we just have to enter cautiously on things. We've definitely learned get samples made up front wherever you can. It may cost you more in the beginning, but if for some reason it just doesn't do well at a show or that sort of thing, you just don't move forward with it. And I have had to do that before. You know, we'll take a couple orders at a show for something and it didn't meet the numbers that we needed it to. And so we had to let those retailers know, unfortunately, it didn't proceed into production, mm-hmm. which is not a fun conversation. But at the end of the day, I'd rather do that than lose thousands of dollars.
Of course. And so. Your reputation too. I mean, yes. it's better to have that open line of communication and tell them, hey, we're actually not moving forward with this product. I think too, I was just talking with somebody about this at camp again, about prototyping and how in some cases in most cases, it's totally fine to prototype so long as you're opening those lines of communication and letting people know that, hey, this is not what the finished product is exactly going to look like, but, you know, right. you can see our quality in these other things as well. So, yep. But in your case with sampling, I mean, it was the actual product that was going to be sold. It's not like when you're running, you know, a letterpress card digitally for the show right. or something like that. So, okay, cool. So how soon after starting Bell & Union and like really diving into the wholesale world and the shows and everything, how soon did you start working with sales reps?
The first like real diving in with sales rep, I would say, was 2 years later.
Okay.
So I had my feet pretty wet at that point. I had been approached at my very first show by a fairly reputable large group.
I remember that conversation with you.
Yeah, which was very flattering and exciting and kind of scared the crap out of me.
Yeah.
And I decided, you know what? I'm just getting going with this. I need to learn the lay of the land a little bit. And so I said, thanks, but no thanks. I'll happy to be in touch. And 2 years later, he came back and I signed then because I felt more comfortable and ready to kind of grow the business that way.
Let me interrupt you right there. And let's talk about some of the ways you felt more comfortable. Let me guess a few. Like you probably felt more comfortable talking about your product and taking the orders from the – yes.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not the best salesperson. I'm still learning. But yeah, I mean, I think I knew more of the business side of things, I would say. I mean, I went to art school. They don't really prepare you for how to run a business.
Right.
So, I mean, just even the order process and just dealing with invoicing and all of that stuff, I felt much more like a well-oiled machine in a lot of ways, to the point that if these reps brought in massive amounts of orders, I was prepared to be able to fulfill those in a timely manner, because a lot of rep groups have expectations of they send you an order, you ship it out within 2 days.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm still a small business. There's just a handful of us here, only two of us that are full time. So it was, you know, a lot of consideration before diving in like that with reps.
Absolutely. Do you feel in general that it has helped your business grow working with reps?
I do. I won't lie. I think reps are a love-hate relationship, especially dependent on the group that you're with. It's all about lines of communication, I think, more than anything, and managing expectations. There certainly can be a lot of hand-holding. It helped us when we designated a person within the company to kind of be a rep liaison, okay. so to speak, someone who can send out regular communications like, hey, this is a brand new product. It's really great. Share it with your stores, that kind of thing. It's with reps, I think a lot of people expect to be able to just sit back and let the reps do the work. And to some extent, some of them may be that way. But in my experience, you got to kind of coax them a little bit.
Well, one thing we talk about at camp too is like stocking the reps with the supplies they need to really do a great job. So why don't you talk a little bit about the things that you give your reps to sell your products?
Well, it's expensive. Yeah. I mean, jumping in with a rep group, I mean, the cost of it is definitely something to consider as well before moving forward. If you're dealing with a group that has 30 people, that's 30 different decks you have to send out. Mm-hmm. With paper rep groups specifically, they expect a full deck that has at least one of every card.
Yeah.
And like with my line, I have close to 150 cards. That's not cheap.
Yeah.
Especially when you multiply it times 30. And then you have to send them catalogs. And then, I mean, if you're adding products on a quarterly basis, that's four times a year that you're sending out 30 mailings.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it adds up very quickly and you have to factor that cost in. And then they get a commission on top of every order they get. Mm-hmm. So I think the showroom fees were probably the biggest surprise to me as far as
expectations. In terms of how much they were?
No, I mean, that varies group to group and show to show for sure. But it's a lot of money. And
it is.
I justified it as I can't go to that show an exhibit for that amount of money.
Right.
So there's benefit to it in that way. But as with anything, you're going to get out of it what you put into it.
Talk about that a little bit more.
Sure. So, I mean, it comes back to that handholding a little bit. I mean, I'm, you know, if I'm paying a rec group to show my line in Atlanta, but I'm not there personally, I'm relying on them to do their job, which it is their job. But at the same time, I'm the designer. I'm the owner. No one's going to know my line and my company the way that I do. So if I kind of take a back seat, sales probably aren't going to be what they could be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you get in what you put out. So.
It's a push and pull for sure. I mean, I agree with you. Nobody's going to tell your story the way you tell it. Nobody's going to describe the products and how, you know, you've created them start to finish, you know, truly from growing the cotton the way you can, even if you do give them sales details about that stuff. So I agree with you. I think there's also a very big difference, in my opinion, working with the larger showroom reps, like you've described, versus like the road reps, where it's a smaller scale. And I mean, some of the road reps have groups too, but they're not nearly what the larger showroom reps are. But I agree with
you.
It's
a different feel.
It is. It's a different feel.
It's still, you still have to put that effort into it.
Definitely. Yeah, so. I always talk about it in the sense that, like, they're a part of your team, and you need to make sure that they have the tools that they need to do the job, whether it's, you know, the catalogs or the samples or even the pitch points. But, you know, you also need to – they need to communicate with you, too, about how things are going on there.
It's definitely a give-and-take relationship, and, I mean, you'll learn throughout the process. Some people are better at that than others.
Totally.
And I think people need to not feel bad walking away from reps if it's not the right fit.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're only hurting yourself and your business if you're staying in a relationship that's really just not working.
Totally. I would also say that I've seen a lot of people, back to your point about like handing off the sales is a great thing. Like everyone kind of wants to hand off a piece so that they don't have to focus on it. And I hear that a lot from people. Like, I just want to hire, you know, especially brand new companies to the industry of, I just want to, you know, get a sales rep so that they can take care of that piece. And I think they really underestimate the amount of involvement that you as a manufacturer still have to have in that relationship, because
yes,
there are, they need you releasing new products on a regular basis. They need you having new catalogs and samples for them to show their stores, and they're going to have questions or special circumstances with their you know, accounts that they're placing orders. So there definitely has to be that open line of communication, and it's not just a matter of passing off something in your business. The sales are not the thing that you can just pass off. Like, it's still...
No. I mean, as nice as that would be, it's definitely not a reality.
Totally. At least not yet. No, I don't know that it ever is, although, you know, maybe for some people it is, but...
Possibly. Some well-known lines, maybe.
Right. So... Let's talk about, you know, I like this podcast to focus on both the successes as well as some of the struggles that we've all been through, because I think there's so much power in hearing everybody's stories. Can you tell us about a transitional time for Bell & Union and how you kind of got through it?
Sure. It's actually a quote that I think you have ended up using in TSBC a lot, that trade shows are a marathon, not a sprint.
I quote you on it all the time.
Yeah. There's a story behind that quote. So, you know, I dove in headfirst with the stationery show in 2012, and it was great. And I got those 50 orders, and I was on a high, and I got home, and I started totaling what it was going to cost to actually make all this stuff. And I sound like I cry all the time, which I rarely do, but I was sitting on the sofa with my mom going through these orders, totaling out what I would need just to create the inventory. And it was something like $20,000,
mm-hmm.
which, I mean, to some people that may not be a lot of money, but to me, I had just spent every dime I had fought for at the trade show. Because, of course, going to a trade show is not cheap. So it was a little bit of a, oh crap, how am I actually going to make all this stuff and fill these orders? So I, unfortunately, you know, was looking to the trade show as the end goal, not thinking past it. And that was a huge hurdle. So I did have to take out a small loan in the very beginning just to get through making that inventory. And it was a hard lesson learned.
Yeah.
But I mean, I think we all have to kind of learn that at the beginning. Like, so that's why I definitely, it's a marathon, not a sprint. It's not just about that show. It's about the relationships and filling those orders and keeping things going past May of every year.
Right. Oh, I Yes, I love that quote. In fact, I use it regularly and reference back to you with it. And I jotted a note down here before we started talking, because I think it's so important for people to hear that, whether or not they're going to shows, whether or not they are selling wholesale. I think it's applicable to everything we're doing in our business. Mm-hmm. You know, setting goals for yourself and knowing that it extends, you know, the life of your business extends past that goal, whether it's a short-term or a long-term goal. So
it's so easy to get caught up in, oh, I've got these brand new products that are launching next month, and I'm working toward that. And then that day finally comes and it's like, yay, I'm here. What now?
Right.
Oh, wait, I actually have to go sell these.
Right.
So it's just, it's this constant hamster wheel in a lot of ways, but that's small business. I mean, yeah. A lot of us wear all the hats.
Yep.
And so it's just making sure that you're juggling all of them and keeping the business moving forward. So yeah, definitely a marathon.
Oh yeah, I agree. Speaking of the hamster wheel, and you know, I agree with you. I feel like sometimes these launches, these product releases can feel anticlimactic because we've worked so hard to create that product and then we send it out in an email to the world and it's like, okay,
yep.
You know, and then we wait and then, you know, we build a social media strategy around it or we, you know, whatever it is that we're doing to promote it. But what kind of systems have you built around your product launches and releases? I know you're great on social media and you do a lot of email stuff. Talk about what you do there and how you kind of do your new releases.
It's really within the last 6 months that I feel like we finally kind of hit our stride as far as launches go. You know, we've been working with rep groups for about 2 years now, and inevitably I was always 2 weeks after a rep show with the new product, just the way schedules end up lining up. So that never worked out. But we didn't start utilizing things like newsletters until about 6 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that was probably a huge mistake on my part, because how else can you get your product directly into someone's hands? I mean, you can't do it any better than that.
Yeah.
So we've definitely started utilizing the e-newsletters to get new product out there. Definitely having a strong social media strategy has been key. And honestly, the biggest part of that, I think, is that I'm not doing it anymore.
You've outsourced that?
I do. I have a girl that I contracted to do it. That's her company is. She does social media management. And I think she has been the single biggest lifesaver I think I've had. Because as much as I love Instagram and Pinterest and all the social media, it was becoming such a time suck of my day. It's like I wake up in the morning, I'm like, okay, what am I going to post today?
Right.
And it's just almost this afterthought thing. Whereas now, you know, we plan out content. You know, we have a calendar and a schedule that we follow. And it shows. We've seen the growth in the last 6 months, not only through our followings, but that translates to sales. And
yep.
So I think just taking the time to actually plan, shocking, I know, it's really groundbreaking, revolutionary here, just kind of organizing things out, even if it is still just you doing your social media, like take the time, plan out your week, like have, you know, maybe a theme for the month. Like I know January this year, we did all about intention, no big light bulb there, but just by putting that word down on paper and kind of letting that guide us. Was huge. And honestly, this was the first year in 4 years that I sat down and wrote business goals.
Really?
Yeah. It's just one of those things that I never got to it.
Right.
You know?
Well, I was just going to say, listening to you talk about social and emails and now goals, it goes back to what you said earlier. As a small business, you're wearing so many hats in your day-to-day work that it's hard to focus on all of the things, right? And most of the time, our attention falls to the things that are most urgent, most time-sensitive, or we try to focus on the revenue-generating things. And sometimes when you're in that, you know, an email list and marketing that way doesn't – we know it ties into the bottom line and the dollars that are coming in, but it's hard to rationalize that when you have 10 things coming at you that need your attention.
Yeah. I mean, it took me 3.5 years to get to that point where I made it a priority.
So are you doing annual goals now? Or I'm just curious, are you doing
quarterly? Yeah, I mean, I made my list of goals for 2017. Some of them have specific kind of timelines based around them. Quite frankly, I don't know that I even looked at them in all of February, because that's just small business life.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, like, I know one of our big goals for this year is opening up a store. And
That's awesome.
So it's like a lot of the decisions I'm making are kind of in thinking of, okay, how is that going to help us reach that goal?
Yeah.
So
I'm going to detour a little bit here, but I'm a big fan of annual goals and kind of having one overarching, you know me, I'm all about the plans and the checklists and the goals.
It's the best way to be.
sometimes my husband's like, what are you doing to me? But I am a fan of even just like one overarching goal that kind of drives all decisions. So for 2017, one of my goals is to, well, my main goal is to re-engage with our alumni community, particularly those of you like yourself that came through our programs, you know, years ago. And so that's what's led to doing the podcast and doing some other programs that we're doing. And I think that when you have that overarching goal, it really does make the decision-making process easier in a lot of ways, because you know, well, does this meet what I'm trying to do? And then you say yes or no, and you move forward. So I love that you're starting the store, and I know you have a big move up against you in the next, you're moving your home and your
it's a business. Lot of changes for sure. Even just taking the time to put it down on paper.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I'm a big list maker, so it works for me. I know it doesn't necessarily work for everyone.
Yeah.
But just having something you can come back to and give you that focus. I mean, I think it's great to have one goal. I read an article recently, and I'm probably going to completely mess this up, but it was talking about how the best way to be productive is to sit down the night before and make a list of 5 to 6 things. Put them in priority order. And that way, when you get up the next morning, you know exactly what you need to do. There's no delay. Like, oh, what am I supposed to do today?
Right.
I mean, we all have a million different things we need to do.
Totally.
We're small business owners. That's just life for us. So I think just taking the time to break it down and give yourself that focus, it's amazing how much more you can get done.
Totally. And two, breaking it down into just 5 things, like it keeps you from getting distracted by email, social media, like all the different things that are coming at us every day. And like you said, it's, you feel accomplished at the end of the day when you've crossed all 5 things off. And
exactly. And in that same kind of thread of like creating that one goal that gives your focus, I would honestly encourage people to take the time to write out their purpose or their mission statement.
Yes.
Again, it's one of those things that has taken me years to finally do. It was something I knew. I felt it, but I never took the time to write it down and really think about what it means. And I honestly have it taped to my computer now.
That's awesome.
So I can see it all the time. And again, just having that driving force, knowing, okay, why am I doing what I'm doing? What are we working toward? It changes things. And it's literally just something as simple as writing it down.
Totally.
And it completely has changed my perspective and growth for sure.
Well, and I think some of that can change too. I mean, ultimately the mission behind your business is not really going to fluctuate that much. You know, we get into this for one reason, and it typically tends to stay the same, but the goals are going to change, and that's okay. Like, it's okay to pivot and change things as you go too. So awesome. Well, hey, tell us what's next for Bell & Union. What do you guys have on tap for the rest of the year? What are you working on in terms of new product, if you can share?
Sure. Well, one of my big goals for 2017 was actually getting ahead of schedule as far as product launches.
Nicely done.
Because inevitably it's the week before a show and I'm still designing cards.
Yeah.
Which I'm trying to get better about that. I'm probably already behind for August at this point. We're actually trying something new this year. We're going to launch some retail only products.
Nice.
So we're planning to have that out around Mother's Day. And then we'll do a launch right before the August New York Now. I don't know that we're actually going to go to that show, which will be new for us. Just there's a lot of personal stuff going on this summer. The move, you know, we've alluded to that. It's big. It's only a few hours away, but moving 4 massive letterpresses is no easy feat.
No way. Yeah.
An entire studio full of inventory. It'll be a lot to deal with. So we're kind of playing that one by ear right now. But I want to make sure that just because I'm not at a show, I don't let the products fall by the wayside.
Right.
But we've definitely been focusing on smaller launches and really just putting more time and effort and energy into making those extra special. Since we are so much about, you know, artisan made goods and the handmade, I think it makes sense to have these small batch creations. It fits that mission statement, you know,
yeah.
We keep coming back to that. So definitely being very intentional with the products that we're launching and I'm hoping by the end of the year to have a little storefront to be able to share with the community. And just yesterday, I was actually talking with a friend about what it means once I have the shop, because it's so easy, again, to get wrapped up and just get to that shop opening, just get there.
Right.
But it's like, okay, what happens after that? And she got me thinking about that. And I'd love to do seasonal supper clubs.
Oh, you know? So fun.
Yeah. So it's just like, there's so much life beyond just getting to that point. And it's fun to think about that and all the possibilities. So I'm really excited for the move and what it means for our family and for the business. So that's definitely the big thing for this year.
That sounds amazing. Awesome. Well, let's tell people where they can find you online. Give us it all.
Okay. Everything is going to be at Bell and Union Co. Everybody tends to forget the co, but online, just our website is bellandunion.com.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Meg, for joining us today, and best of luck with the move and everything else you have coming up for this year.
Thank you. It was great to be able to share our story.
Of course. All right. Talk to you guys soon.
Proof to Product is brought to you by Trade Show Bootcamp and hosted by me, Katie Hunt. Since 2011, TSBC has worked with hundreds of product-based businesses to help them uplevel, scale, and build profitable, sustainable companies. You can find our show notes and additional resources at prooftoproduct.com. And if you like what you heard today, please head over to Apple Podcasts to leave a 5-star review and subscribe. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode.